Hello, friends. When we think of setting our students up for success post-graduation, often the topic of student loans come up, and there's a need for governments to forgive student loans to set them up for success. But is that the only way forward? In my second conversation with Professor Willie Elliott, we talk about setting children up with assets as early as possible. Welcome to Open Minds. It's the podcast that attempts to explore with genuine curiosity the world's most intriguing issues. Some topics include climate change, gun control, basic income, and so much more. I invite guests on who are both proponents and detractors of these issues so that we can be exposed to more nuanced perspectives we may not be hearing. You can find me at openmindspodcast.com or anywhere you stream music. I'm your host, Christopher Balkrin, and welcome to Open Minds. I always really enjoy my conversations with Professor Willie Elliott out of the University of Michigan, because his perspectives on what we should do for students thinking of getting into university, as well as those currently in university, is so refreshing. It's just a very different way of thinking about student loans and how to finance your entire post-secondary career. And this conversation is no different. This conversation, we talk quite explicitly about why it is the case that governments often look to forgive student loans as a way in which to remove barriers for more students to gain entry into university. Our conversation was very interesting, and it kind of dovetailed around a lot of different issues. So I hope you enjoy this one. Shameless plug, definitely check me out at theopenmindspodcast.com. I'll leave a link in the description. And if you haven't already, follow my Instagram, where I've been posting reels and they've been getting a lot of views. I lost my voice over the weekend cheering for the Toronto Maple Leafs. Some of you might know that Toronto finally made it past the first round. So I'm still recovering from that, but I cannot wait to share with you more episodes. I hope you enjoy this one, and I'll catch you in the next one. The Department of Education under President Biden will provide up to $20,000 in debt cancellation to Pell Grant recipients with loans held by the Department of Education, and up to $10,000 for the non-Pell Grant recipients. I wanted to begin by asking you, why is it that we often hear of debt cancellation as the federal government's approach to enabling more students access to higher education?
I think it's rather simple in that much of what can be done right now in the political landscape in the U.S. at least is through executive order, mm-hmm. right? And so the options are very limited with regard to what president can do by himself without action by Congress. Secondly, it is a bit for the public, it's more acceptable, the cancellation of loans, particularly at smaller amounts, mm-hmm. right? As opposed to debt relief. I actually would strongly suggest interest, reducing interest rates or eliminating interest. I think that might even be a better way of canceling debt is taking off the excess from interest that has accumulated over time. So rather than saying I'm doing $20,000 in debt, saying we're going to remove all the interest, let the people pay back the principal. And I wanted to read kind of a couple of stats here for you. Mm-hmm. 9 years after leaving school, the 2000, and this data is somewhat old, but because you have to do it when they have it for students. So 9 years after leaving school, the 2005 cohort has paid down only 38% of its original student debt.
Wow.
Under a standard 10-year amortization schedule, these loans would be approaching full repayment, and only about 10% of the original balance would remain. This is Brown et al. I want a couple more quick stats that are similar to this. Regarding racial disparities, 4 years after earning a bachelor's degree, Black graduates in the 2008 cohort held $24,720 more student loan debt than white graduates.
Wow.
It was less than $2,000 in 1993, so we see that this continued to grow. Of high balance borrowers, 22% have student loan balances higher in 2014 than they did in 2009, even without ever falling into severe delinquency or default. Last one here. Nearly half, 48% of all Black graduates owe more on their federal undergraduate loans than they did at graduation, compared to just 17% of white graduates. But the point just being is that these loans, even if they're relatively small in the beginning, continue to grow over time just because of the interest rate. And so I think, while certainly any help is welcomed, that focusing on this interest rate and the amount of interest owed would be and I think it applies to people's moral values in some sense too. Might fit because we're not saying they don't have to pay back the debt. Even though I could make an argument for that, we're only saying we're not going to charge them interest on that debt, right? And that would actually alleviate far more burden on families than, you know, $20,000 or $10,000 cut.
Professor, that's a fascinating stat about the 50%, over half of Black students graduating with higher debt loads. What does that translate into the job market in comparison? Because I can imagine that the job opportunities become more narrow when you've got this higher debt burden, because you're thinking, wow, I need to have a job that pays X amount just for me to afford a place to live, as well as pay down my debt at the same time. Whereas those with lower levels of debt may have more flex and freedom in terms of the types of careers and jobs that they pursue right out of university. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, actually, Rothenstein and Rouse in 2011 did a study on that, and they found just that. What usually hurts low-income and minority students is with regard to whether they take the kind of job. So it affects both ways, but it affects the kind of job they might take. And so they might decide that even though taking a job paying a bit less, but actually gives you much more credentialing along the way, so you can make far more in the future, they'll take a job that pays a little bit more, as opposed to taking that job that would actually have far much more career benefit because they're in debt.
Wow.
Saying that, somebody like Herbenstein found that low-income children make about a third less in income. But really what happens is in the beginning they make more, then over time they make less, right? Because they're taking these jobs that have these initial income benefits but don't provide the long-term benefit, if you will. And so, and you see that on the front end of education too, is they'll go to schools or go to places that are cheaper when they would have been better off going to sometimes a more prestigious college or a four-year college as opposed to a two-year college, because Black children and low-income children to a much higher degree go to two-year colleges. And while there's this whole movement around two-year colleges in other careers, you make less long-term.
Wow.
Right? Yeah. And so we created this system that is really assuring that the degree doesn't pay off the same for low income and minority students that it does for others, which really is problematic in our whole system of using education as a great equalizer in society, if you think about it. So debt has fundamentally played a role in both how people perceive college, whether it's worth it. It not only with what jobs they take afterwards, but there's research on they delay marriage. They don't get married as soon, which we know that being married is a very important thing in economic outcomes, actually, right? And so, again, it's having this role. You earn less by the time they reach their 40s. Net worth is less. So they don't feel like they can invest or in their retirement savings is lower because they don't feel like they can start it right away because they're in this debt, right? They also have they're less likely to buy a home early on, so that means they have less equity in it long term. And when they do buy a home, they have poor rates and stuff, and so they buy it in poor, you know, not as good of neighborhoods, where you know they owe more on it. So there's these like stacked up long-term consequences
Yeah.
that people feel. And so when we have this moment when people are increasingly thinking that education doesn't pay, and that they're better off doing these other kinds of degrees and things, debt has played a large role in that.
Professor, sometimes we also think about race and the disparity, and sometimes thinking about race when it comes to admission criteria and then success rates, and building that somehow there's this racial component to why Black students in particular are not pursuing higher education, why they're dropping out in higher rates, and perhaps why they're not finishing like STEM majors in the way that non-Black students are. But also, I think what you've just mentioned are choices are so important. In fact, 2-year college degrees, you earn less, and that may be affecting the outcomes as well that we're seeing. So while race is very important, the system itself may be structured in a way that positions more 2-year college degrees to Black students, in itself not necessarily being racist, as some might suggest it to be. Is that fair as well?
Yeah, I mean, structured in a way, and so let me say it this way. So we also funnel, we think we're doing a good thing. So your part about, in some ways, like a counselor would sit down with a student nowadays and have a very, and if they're poor, or if they look a certain way, you know, if they're Black or Hispanic, or they'll feel as though the best choice for the student to avoid debt is to go into a 2-year college. Understanding that the rates of going to a 4-year college afterwards are much lower, right? And that there just is, and I have some data here, I have to look for it, but on how much more often Black students are likely to go to a 2-year college. But part of it is like we're telling them to do that. Like we think we're doing them a good deed by saying, and we're even trying to create federal programs for free college and stuff, typically in the US has meant something like a 2-year college program, which only means that low-income kids, Black kids, minority kids will be much more likely to be funneled into these 2-year colleges than they already are. I mean, they're already getting that advice. And that will be creating a structure that almost demands that they go to these colleges. And the problem becomes when they're, and we already know through data that they are much more likely, even when they qualify, to go to a Harvard, to a Yale, or to a much more, you know, prestigious type college. And while we want to tell people that it doesn't matter, and there are even some, I would say, bad studies that show that, some good studies that show the opposite of that, that it matters. So, for example, real quick, you know, I grew up low income, blah, blah, blah. I think we've talked through that before, so I won't beat that up here. But I ended up going to Washington University in St. Louis. Not everybody knows that school, but it is a pretty high-end private school, right? I mean, as far as academically goes, so it's like an Ivy school in many ways, and it actually is tended by a lot of more wealthy people. But my point is here is that one of the things that struck me while I was there is that, and I and didn't really, you know, you're just traveling through life as a low-income individual, and so when somebody tells you it matters more to go to a much more prestigious college, you're like, you can't really understand it, right? I mean, it's not really tangible to you in a way because you just have nothing to base it off of to understand. When I went to WashU, man, I mean, the resources that I got, it was, I don't know that the teaching is necessarily that much better, but you are walking around a campus with Nobel Prize winners and taking classes with Nobel Prize winners, right? I mean, literally, Douglas North took classes with them, right? You know what I mean? And you, the opportunities for travel, for doing research that's funded while you're a PhD student is just so much different than at schools when I taught at the University of Kansas. What we provided our students was a very different kind of experience than what I, and then when you leave, people say, oh, you graduated from WashU, number one ranked social work school in the country. You look different on the job market, right? I mean, so I don't know. These studies that tell you that these things don't matter, there's many studies that do, but there are some that say that practically speaking, right, it matters.
Definitely, 100%. Professor, I, you know, sometimes we think about Sometimes the argument about higher education gets, quote unquote, dumbed down to if only low-income students had access to Ivy League colleges and universities, the outcomes would be so different. And I don't think that's the right, or that's perhaps one of many approaches, but access is just one, like, bucket in the whole idea of success. To me, it's, you know, what types of programs are there, you know, taking students from low-income communities and putting them into Ivy League schools is a culture shift. People talk about dropout rates being higher. Well, I can understand that because the environment is so different. So what was your experience like in WashU? And did you feel the same, that this environment was just so different and you could kind of understand why students from low-income backgrounds say, you know, this is just too much. This is overwhelming for me. Regardless of grades and performance, this environment is too much. Is that also fair?
I think it's also fair, but problematic, because then it feeds into this narrative that if you're low income, you're better off going to a 2-year or lesser school.
Correct.
So the change needs to come in the environments. Yes. I mean, just from the standpoint of income alone, that the people there who think they're poor are taking trips to Europe in the summers and complaining that they don't have money. Right? These people, I mean, the people, I'm not degrading it. It just is the fact that for someone in at the time I was in there, like in the New York Times and stuff, had articles after I got out, was a period in which they actually were giving, and this is documented, were giving low-income kids less financial aid. Wow. And giving high-income kids more financial aid.
Wow.
Because it made them more prestigious to have the higher-income kids attend than the lower-income kids.
This is well documented. Wow.
In several papers and in research done on it. And so I actually think, we're getting back around to the student debt piece, is that a student like myself who came out with over $100,000 in student debt, understanding that these institutions systematically provided us with less aid, should have to repay some of that debt for those students in that interest that's earned over time. And that's not just because I'm going to make it, right? But the fact that they can get away with having done this, and the only thing that happens is an article in the paper, and them not have to restore these students to some degree. I would say the same thing for for-profit institutions that are feeding off of low-income students. They should not only be penalized through the paper, they should be penalized monetarily and have to reimburse these students in some form, take on some level of their student debt, because they're making profit hand over fist over feeding off of low-income students. But that's back, just real quick, back to your point. Mm-hmm. Yes, but I think it's too easy of an answer simply to say, low-income student, you should just go to another type of school that doesn't, even though you qualify for this type of school, you should go to a lesser school that's going to provide you less opportunities in the long run. What should happen is there needs to be changes at these universities to make sure when they bring students in that are low-income minority students, that they have the resources available to them to navigate that system. And I'm going to be honest with you. And this is very unpopular, I think, to say, is some of the onus comes on the student themselves.
Yeah.
This is rough. It's unfair. But my experience in life, the life is unfair.
Yeah.
And so I shouldn't say it should fall on them. But because no one else is doing anything, we also have to, as minorities, tell our fellow young students who are minorities, like, you are going to feel lonely in these things, and help provide them with some networks by ourselves. I don't know. We have to encourage them to push through, because the more of them that push through, even like in Obama's administration, right? A black president, I thought he did a fairly good job, but he hired an inordinate amount of people from Ivy League schools to work in his administration.
Correct, yeah.
So if we deny these students or don't encourage them to take advantage of these opportunities, we are not allowing them to rise to the level that we need them to rise to really change this. Because the way to really change it is to get more people of color, more low-income families in general, into these positions so that they can help other people, right? But if they don't ever, if no one ever like goes through that suffering, it is a bit of suffering. I felt very out of place at WashU. Even today, I'm a fairly well-recognized person, not as much as some, but I'm reasonably recognized, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I still don't feel at ease at WashU. I still recognize myself as less than when I'm there. And I think faculty there sometimes, certainly some of them, see me as less than.
Interesting. Right?
And I don't think that will ever change.
Wow.
And I can, if I didn't want to, I don't want to put all their dirt on the kind of podcast, but, mm-hmm. but yeah, I can speak to some even real experiences today that have happened. When I'm this far down in my career, yeah, that are real. So yeah, I mean, we have to, unfortunately, we need some of these students to bear that burden. Because the real change will only come if we get in those positions and in those places, and then we can begin to make kind of real change.
Yeah, that's so unfortunate, Professor. Because if people didn't listen to our first podcast together where you described your life story, that should humble every single person when they're talking to you. You mentioned that it should part of this does fall on the student. I wanted to ask you about that, and I know we're getting a bit sidetracked because I definitely want to delve into your research, but. I talked to Professor Peter Archidiacono at Duke University, and some research coming out of Duke shows that I think 58% of Black male students drop out of STEM fields in comparison to white males, which I think is around 20%. So it's much higher. And one of the researchers suggested, you know, we need to talk to more Black male students who dropped out to understand why they dropped out. And I kind of had this thought that if I'm a Black male student and I'm dropping out of the STEM field at Duke, as an example, I'm not talking to a researcher, right? I'm not talking to the faculty. I'm not talking to the academia. Like, I'm done. It's over. I'm moving on to my next chapter in my academic career or my professional career. How do you reach out to students that have dropped out of STEM fields in this example to make the university experience more accessible, better for the next generation coming up so we can see that number go down? That must be super challenging for the academia and researchers to do.
Yes, I'll say two things on that. One, I'll go back to, I think my wording of, I mean, it is complicated to say, put some of the burden on students. It shouldn't be that way. It just is that way, right?
And
so I'm not, I mean, I don't think it should be that way, but on the other hand, we just need some, we need more, and we need to encourage them to be able to and try to provide them with supports because we need them to get through. I think, and I find this in the poverty, in the poverty research I do as well, same thing that you're talking about, is that, and it's not a race bound, right? Because I've seen Black professors, so even for, I've used too many examples close by, but, even in my own experience in academia, oftentimes when I run into Black professors, not often, but sometimes, I don't get the sense that they had any of the experiences that I've had. So oftentimes they come from their parents were professors or whatever else, right? And so so it's just not 100% race bound because even in a real problematic part is even though they've had none of these experiences, they feel like they're experts on these topics, right? And so, but yet if you're someone who is low income and they're talking to you, you feel that vibe, right? You feel that sense that like, this is not one of us.
Definitely.
This person hasn't had the same experiences that I've had. And it's not necessarily that someone have all the same experiences, but it's problematic when that comes across, right? Then it becomes a barrier to being able to do the research. I think in some ways, going back to my WashU friends, is they're probably not wrong about me in some ways, is that I am not the brightest professor I know. by any stretch of the imagination. And I'm not saying that's humility or anything else. I mean, I think it's practically true. I'm trying to be very honest with myself about where I'm at. That doesn't mean I haven't had great impact and I can't do things. It just means that, and I think it has actually helped me, because what I do is I'm always constantly thinking about how do I translate my research to everyone else. I spend a lot of time thinking about how do I connect with people like me, the average person in society, right? Whereas and I think these all goes to the difficulty in interacting with students who might have dropped out and finding out what's going on, is they have to feel some connection between what you're doing, some honesty with you, some trust, some that you can see them, you know what I mean? And that you're not speaking past them. And I think there are roadblocks for some faculty in being able to do that, because, they, at the end of the day, they really think of themselves as being smarter than everybody else. And they spend a lot of time using jargon to hide their research instead of revealing their research. And I talk to my PhD students here a lot about that, though I don't think it gets through because to many of them, just because we're at a very prestigious kind of public university, and talking in jargon makes you sound so smart. And so you spend so much of your time doing that, hiding your research. I don't know. So I think those are things that make it difficult. But again, I would say to those students that, well, I'll say two quick things. One thing is, I don't know that we need to do research on some of this. So why do Black students drop out at a higher rate than other students? Like, I mean, some of this is like, do I really need to go out and talk to them about this? I mean, we don't provide them with any supports while they're here. They're isolated in a sense of, particularly, I mean, like, I have never been in the STEM fields per se, but I'm a Black professor. I make up, 3% of all professors, right? And
That's
I'm telling
insane.
you, many of the ones who are Black, I don't relate to, because they're not either. They just were able to so far remove themselves from their past that you no longer really have that connection in that, right? So they could have been poor in some cases, but they've been so indoctrinated into the academia that they no longer have touch with it. I'm talking too long, but my
No.
point is simply that, it's complicated, right? But many of these things aren't that complicated, in that we know, like, hey, if they're there and they feel very isolated, they don't have any friends and anybody to connect with, they're much more likely to drop out, particularly if it gets hard, right? Because then, you just there's this you can find less and less reasons to do it, unless you're just like, I'm going to change the world, right? I mean, and just
So
not
true.
everybody's going to have that mindset. So we don't really, I mean, we need to do studies and we need to talk to them, but at the same time, there's many things we could already be doing. If you come out of a lower, even if you had good grades, but you come out of a school that doesn't provide a lot of the academics opportunities that more, better high schools have, so you don't have the opportunity to do calculus and get tutoring, and you don't have a chance to travel and do those other things, right? All these things or do the summer thing where you go and do engineering classes at University of Michigan or something during the summer. All those, and they all cost money, right? Like, I want to put my son in, it's like $2,000 to put him in it, right? You know what I mean? Like, who's not, it's not available to everybody. And so they go to school, the college, with all this other background. Not only did they have their A's, they had all these other experiences that put them so far ahead. And now I'm thrust into a room with them and we say compete, right? I mean, and I might feel overwhelmed. I mean, I can remember being, this is a much lower level than the STEMs, when I went into my philosophy classes as an undergrad, I came in, I was a high school dropout, and so I was in on probation and stuff. And the students in there would actually laugh at me at times and say, look at his writing. But now, fortunately, the professor there could see my thinking. So even though I didn't have all the grammatical stuff nailed down yet and all those kinds of things, because I didn't have it, he could see that. And so, and that was highly self-efficacy, right? I mean, to a delusional level, to where I could withstand the kind of abuse. I mean, when I went to my PhD program, when I got accepted and I was at the little event that you go to see all the professors, one of the professors told me, you don't deserve to be here, right? So you're faced with all these, and he wasn't 100% wrong in that my GRE scores weren't as high as some other people's, right? Mm-hmm. But I had done so much research as an MSW student that that's what got me in, right? The work effort and the stuff that I produced put me in there, even though I couldn't do, because I didn't have I dropped out of high school. I didn't have all the basic math that other people had, right? I could do the statistics that we had to do in the PhD program, but I didn't have all the stuff that I, you know, wasn't in school for, if you will, right? So doing a GRE test is about that stuff from way back then. It's not just measuring your current ability, but it's measuring whether you know all the formulas and all. So my point is, like, you're thrusting these students into this environment, and they look on the face, because they got good grades and did whatever else, like, they're equal, but they haven't had all these other experiences, and it's being revealed to them again and again in different environments. Oh, I'm behind on this. Oh, I'm behind on that. I got to make up for this. I got to make up. I thought I was doing good, and now I'm behind, right? These things are very complicated for an individual to push through, not easy.
You're totally right, Professor. In fact, I think more people need to understand the complex nature of that, and the level of competition, even amongst non-Black students entering into universities. Sometimes people forget that as well. Like, competition is very fierce, especially in the STEM fields. It's not easy.
Not even be about competition necessarily, right? It's just the fact that you're sitting in that room. It's not that I'm competing against that person, but it makes me understand I'm behind. Hmm. That right. Even though I had A's, I'm behind. That can be very revealing and shocking. And now the question is, and even the professor in the room might not acknowledge that, but that exists. This other person has all this other training that they've gotten that's put them ahead. And so they don't provide the supports that are needed for that student to make up for that stuff they didn't get, that the person was getting on the side because their family could provide them with all these other opportunities. You look at these high income families, it's not about their A's. It's about all the other garbage that they're able to do
right
every summer along the way that puts them in such a better position. So competition is right. I mean, there is competition, but this is not even about competition. It's just about the fact that I'm sitting there and I'm behind.
Right.
And what that does. Recognize that I'm behind, and what it's going to require for me to try to catch up is so much more than the other student who already, even if we're not competing, they create a really good environment, but I'm still behind. That's just the reality of it.
And what that does to the mentality, anxiety, stress levels, depression might easily kick in, especially when you know that you've worked so hard to maintain that high GPA in high school, and knowing that you're now at maybe a C student, maybe even lower. I can totally see how anxiety, stress, and depression can easily set in for young people. You know, in my podcast, as you mentioned about professors and the jargon that they're using, I've noticed that the most engaging podcasts are those professors who have both academic and real world and real life experience. And I think that's perhaps why we've had great conversations, because you blend the two. And those that stay in one realm of academia, I often, the answers I get are very, I wouldn't say superficial, but there's not that touch of reality. There's not that touch of, there's a real consequence to this public policy decision that I'm advocating for. And I think that's what makes, to me, a good professor. It's one that understands the public policy implications through real life experience and real world experience with their academic background as well.
One quick note on that, do understand also that academia doesn't reward that.
Correct.
And so we created a structure, a system that really, you get many more points for going and talking to other academics in a setting that is about jargon, is about showing off your prowess, is about, you know, those kind of things. We get rewarded for publishing in journals and not trans. And journals don't want you to translate your research; they want you to keep it for the academic, you know, environment. There are structural things here that perpetuate this, and that reward this. And so we need to do some things that reward people for taking the time and the effort to translate their research. And if you're trying to get tenure, like I'm past tenure and all those things, but if you're trying to get tenure and stuff, I mean, these are real hard decisions for a person to make. Put the time into writing a report that I'm going to get, you know, that translates my research, but I'll get no credit for, or do more journal articles. And so I think it becomes this snowball effect. And at some point, you know, you end up doing the things that you're being rewarded to do.
Professor. Cases. Yeah, a pipe dream of mine is if this podcast, you know, when this podcast becomes this multi-million-dollar, billion-dollar entity, I would love to create a research institute of some sort where, you know, I just feel that there's also, I've noticed in the research too, sometimes I notice research can be very politicized and that there's certain perspectives that are being pushed. And I invite those professors on, and I notice that even when I provide that pushback, they definitely don't fully engage, or they say, you know, that's not, they provide a kind of high level response. And I wonder, like, imagine if there was a research institute where there wasn't a politicized motive, or there wasn't a, you know, we need to advocate for this specific objective. There was something that was just, let's examine the research for what it is, and let's make sure that we ground that in some real world experience and real life examples that we can actually put forward public policy recommendations that make sense, instead of highlighting some of the jargon and some of the do the research for the sake of doing the research. It's just been something that I've always thought about, because I can see how research institutions and professors have to pigeonhole their research just to get published in these bigger, larger institutions as a result.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I've often thought about leaving academia at some point, just because of kind of the things that are put around you. But at the same time, everything's complicated, right?
Yeah.
And so you don't want, I think sometimes we so avoid a political view as well. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Mm-hmm. It's not so, I'm not saying advocating for being a Democrat or being a Republican or Republican view or Democratic view, but sometimes we're so in fear of falling on a side of someone that we don't push for the thing that is best or most in line with facts. One of the things that really stymies up research is the fear of slippery slopes. We run around and we're so afraid. So if I'm an institutionalist, someone who believes that structure matters and that it's not just about the individual or very little about the individual, but mostly about institutions that make decisions and change, then it becomes very hard for me to ever allow for the role of individuals in this process, that we can do both, that both play a role, that institutions, when I'm talking to institutions, I need to talk to them about what they're doing. When I'm talking to individuals, I need to talk to them about what they can do, right? That both play a role. But we're so afraid, and I understand why, because everything is so politicized, that if we're afraid of that discussion, having that debate amongst each other on a stage where we're acknowledging that in some ways Black communities have created gun violence and have done this very, right? I mean, at the same time, it's very structural in nature because of lack of income and in environments that they're placed in, like both of those things have a point. And really, to get to where we need to get to, we need to be able to discuss both of those things, not allowing it to tip one way or the other the conversation. It's not all about, you know, the individual and what they've done. It's not all about the institution, that there's this thing where both of them need to work together to really achieve something. And having those kind of conversations is very difficult for politicians, for academics, because they're just afraid that if they allow any chink in the, so with student debt real quick, when I first started doing research on student debt, I was at the Federal Reserve Bank in St. Louis, And it was a bunch of economists, obviously. And it happened to be that a lot of them were from Washington, D.C. And I was using the Survey and Consumer Finance, which is it's a Federal Reserve Bank developed data set. And in it, I asked a question the question was about student debt and was whether or not someone who has debt does as well as someone who doesn't have debt when they leave college with regard to building assets and stuff, which is a different question than asking whether someone who didn't graduate from college does as well as someone who graduates from college. That tends to be the question that everybody wants to ask. But if we're asking an equity question, it really is about whether the person who graduates with debt does as well as someone who doesn't. When you look at that data, that shows much more often the things we talked about earlier, delays in marriage and all these different kinds of things, right? If you look at the other question, yeah, if you get a college degree, you're going to do better than someone without a college degree on average, right? Not all the time, but on average. And so when I asked that question to them in that of that data, I got a very different answer than what they were getting. Right. And so they interrupted me in the middle of my presentation because economists are economists. And they were like, you could not have found that, you know, because of they said you could not have found that because we looked at this data. Yeah, but you never asked this question. Right. And so I ended up sharing them. And at the time I was young ish in the work. And so I was like baffled by it, and I didn't really respond well at that moment. But they asked me for my data. I sent it to them, and it all kind of showed up and everything. But my point is that a lot of times it has to do with the kind of questions we're asking of the data as well, right? If we haven't asked the appropriate question, then we'll get very different kinds of results. And that's so right. It's just very hard for us to have kind of honest conversations about things. What I wanted to say, to bring it back to our original point, was one of the people who questioned me during the event, in our conversations afterwards, what he said was, and I'm paraphrasing, is that if we raise any questions about the student debt program, what they'll end up doing is taking away the student debt program and not replacing it with anything. Mm-hmm. Right? It's those fears that prevent us from doing what would be most useful and best for low-income students. And so we get stuck with a student debt program that we know harms people. We do tweaks around the margins. What I mean by tweaks around the margins, we do things like, oh, let's let you defer your loans, which only means that interest continues to build and everything else continues to happen while you're not paying it back. So you're worse off in the long run. Or we say, hey, pay it forward, or pay it however that goes, get the exact word, we'll let you do it now, and then when you get a job, you'll pay it back then, right? But the problem with that is then you're still taking away their assets, their ability to build assets, because they have less income to use because they're dumping it over into paying the debt back then, right? So it's still it's this whole mindset that we have to pay student loan. We have to, I forget exactly how I want to say that, but this is this whole mindset that, you know, there's not an alternative solution to debt.
Hmm. Yep. And that's actually a great dovetail into my next question, which is the release of the report Unleashing the Power of Children's Savings Accounts, CSAs, Doorway to Multiple Streams of Assets. I found this so fascinating, building off our last conversation in November. It discusses the perspective of tuition relief as a means to help students complete college and university. And I wanted to first discuss that. Going back to the initial question at the beginning, there's this fixation I find on tuition relief. And your research, yours and others' research, is breaking that down and saying, no, start students with assets. Why is that such a challenging mental barrier for people to kind of overcome and reframe how we understand higher education and successful students that leave our post-secondary institutions to enter the workforce?
History, experience, all these things. So I ended that last section not as well stated as I wanted. I wanted to circle back to that real quick, just to highlight again that he was expressing a fear that many liberals have. If we say anything bad about student debt, we'll end up losing student debt, right? And we'll end up losing that money, and it won't be replaced with anything. And that prevents us from seeing anything else as possible. That ties into kind of what you're talking about here as well. It is these. So one of the things we talk about in that report is, and we give a case study of some programs that are doing this, taking something like a traditional scholarship, which is provided to a student at 18, and putting it into an account early on for them as an early award scholarship, which is different than a promise of money. It's actually putting money into the account early on. But it's hard for people because they've done it so long the one way, to think that we could do it another way, right? Like, because for them, it's like you're attacking the thing that I have so much invested in, the idea that I have so much invested in. And really, it's not. It's just a shift on when we give them the money, right? So it's still a scholarship. We're putting that money into their account. They still can't use it but for college. But it's just very hard for people once they're in a paradigm. So Thomas Kuhn talks about paradigm shifts and stuff and revolutions and how they come about. You have to be in a period of failure and I think we're in that, like we're in this funny little zone, right? We're almost there where like people are questioning so much, is this system working as it is? Do we need to overthrow it or can we work within it or what do we need to do, right? And we're in that moment where there's enough going on, where there's enough kids not making it, where there's enough trouble that people really begin to question the system. And so my point is, to answering your question, is that it's just all this built up. I've done it this way. I never really questioned or thought about why we do it this way, but now I defend it as though it's the best thing to do, the only way to go, right? And so that makes it very difficult to make these changes. But I do sense that we're beginning to think about some of these things. Like there's enough going on that's making people start. You can have somebody, like we're having this question, we're talking about this on a podcast, And most likely we won't be persecuted tomorrow for what we're saying, right? I mean, so this dialogue is possible in a way that it wasn't possible even 10 years ago. Like you weren't talking in public about free college 10 years ago. And I actually think free college is not the way to go as they have prescribed it, though I think free makes sense. Mm-hmm. But you couldn't even have that conversation. We talk about things like baby bonds. Mm-hmm. We talk about things like reparations, mm-hmm. right? And whether you agree with any of those things, the point is we couldn't have those meaningful conversations about those things 10 years ago. But now we talk about them readily in the public.
Professor, that's a very fascinating point. I wanted to actually build off what one thing you had mentioned, and again, something that we've talked about earlier. But in the report, it states, current financial aid policies largely fail to tackle the overlapping and accumulating effects of wealth inequality and instead treats inequality in higher education as only a problem of paying tuition. Again, some like dumbing it down to just tuition and not the overlapping inequality effects. For those that are less aware, what are some of the overlapping and accumulating impacts of wealth inequality? And how does debt relief just not kind of unpack and try to solve that?
So I think it goes back to this whole idea of education as a great equalizer in society in the return on a degree. So we disconnect the conversation about early on, economists decided that the problem that students have is that they don't have enough money to pay for college. Like that's the underlying issue that exists. And so therefore it doesn't matter kind of how you give them money to pay for college. It just matters that you give them money to pay for college. So if you give them debt, If they use debt to pay for college, that's perfectly fine because the how doesn't matter. What we're trying to say in these conversations is that the how actually does matter. And we see that quite clearly now. We could have seen it earlier, and some people did see it earlier. Even when they first started talking about student loans, some people forecasted in the 1970s that this would be the case, right? This is not like, it's not, it wasn't unknown. It was just ignored. And so the thing about why it's not just tuition in several ways is that, first of all, you need to have students in a way that wealth works, is that students who have more wealth are more likely to be prepared to go to college. And even in some of the more nuanced ways that we talked about with regard to STEM in a Black student sitting in the classroom who might have had straight A's, but is not prepared in all those other kind of ways, right? Because the assets that family had, they were able to prepare the student in all those other ways. So that's one factor, right? It's just being prepared to even get the scholarship. And that's why scholarships aren't a great way to go about it, right? If you put that money into the accounts early on that grew up with that money, it can have a lot of other effects on them that helps them be prepared to go to college at that time. Then once you're there, it's not only a matter of did I pay to get in, but it's also how I leave, right? So if I have people who, and we have some short blogs, maybe I'll give you the links, you can attach them to them. We're real practical one-pagers that are short to tell this story of kind of an asset empowered path, and then, you know, the debt path, and then what CSAs could do, right? And it uses kind of one of my fellow colleagues' stories who was more wealthy, and then my story, and it talks you through those different paths. And my point is that we have disconnected our conversations about getting into college, getting through college, and then the return on a degree. If I come out in debt, we've already talked about that I'm less likely to get married, I'm going to have a different kind of job, I'm not going to build wealth, I'm not going to start saving, all these things which make it so that someone like me doesn't buy a house till they're in their 40s, as opposed to someone who buys a house much earlier, right? And so if it's not just about tuition, if we're talking about equality and education working as an equalizer, because it's also about my return on a degree when I leave there. Let me see here. So real quick, research shows that a bachelor degree holders from low-income families start their careers earning about one-third less than those from higher-income families. This is about a return on a degree. This is Hirschbein. Minority children earn less from the degree. Hispanic and Black American students with a degree have less income and net worth than their white Asian counterparts. Look at Emmons and Noah. And degrees do not protect equally. During the Great Recession, Black and Hispanic college graduating families experienced wealth declines far greater than white families without a college degree. So they earn less, they have less wealth, and then anytime an economic storm comes up, their degrees protect them less. That leads to people like Hamilton saying things like Derek Hamilton, who proposed baby bonds, and saying that education is not the great equalizer in society, right? It leads to people in society having experienced these things, telling their kids that maybe college doesn't pay off as much, right? We have much more of that conversation today. It's because we haven't thought about, and student debt is underlining much of this, right? It's shaping much of this conversation. And that's so problematic because people are then thinking that the problem is college, when it really is about how we're financing college and how people leave college. So my colleague, when she left college, first of all, she went into college, her family had money saved for her to go to college, so then she could do a bunch of other things. And then she got scholarships on top of that. So she could use that money that they already had to pay for college to go to Spain and do all kinds of other things while she was in college. When she left, she took a job at a nonprofit, which really elevated her. But at the same time paid less so she could do something like that. Her parents gave her money for a car when she left, money for a down payment on a house. Right? These are how wealthy people live. One more quick example. Even among low-income people, there's nuances and differences. I had a friend, Dan Bozic, and his grandparents, left his parents a house, right? And so they had this house. And then his mother took a job at Geneva College as a secretary. And that actually allowed him to get free college when he went to college, right? And so even though his dad was in the steel mills and he, they closed, and so he ended up becoming a janitor, right? So they weren't wealthy people. They were white, and they were had these resources. And so because he grew up with a house, he would always ask me, why are you always changing neighborhoods? Why is your phone number always changing? Well, I didn't have someone give me a house that they could, anytime they had problems, take out a loan against the house or whatever else, right? They, or get a better loan in the first place because they have a house. All these things. They didn't owe anything on the house, right? And so there was this leverage point that they had at all points. And my point is, tying us back into our conversation, is how one leaves college, having some assets is necessary for them to get a good return on a degree. So when we're thinking about financing college, we also think had to start thinking about giving poor kids some money when they leave college.
That is fascinating, Professor. I wanted to link that with, I'm sure you're aware of Maya Beasley's book back in 2011 called Opting Out. It's about Black students, pretty much Black students not achieving at the same rate as white students and white graduates. So Black and white graduates, Black graduates choose lower level jobs. And the researcher Maya Beasley makes the link that in the 80s and 90s, there were well-intentioned objectives of making Black and Hispanic dorms on campuses. And the reason was that there was this idea that we need to make the environment comfortable for those from underrepresented groups on campuses. But the impact of that was that there wasn't as many cross-racial friendships as a result. And white students were more likely to maintain and make cross-racial friendships. And white students entering universities, this was their bailiwick. They were so used to networking, as you mentioned, like they come from middle and upper middle class income backgrounds. So their idea of interacting with professors about job opportunities, et cetera, was a much higher level. And those from Black and Hispanic backgrounds stayed within Black and Hispanic bubbles on campus, thereby limiting their opportunity to have cross-racial friendships and network with those outside of their race groups that could also impact their job prospects after college and university. And while well-intentioned, the impacts of those after university could be long-lasting as the networking between racial groups wasn't happening amongst underrepresented groups. Do you also agree with that? Because it sounds like there's some evidence to support that as well.
And I think a step further is that it also creates a structure that encourages people not to integrate.
Correct.
And the problem, so there's this thing called social capital. I'm sure you've heard of it.
Yeah.
And I kind of hate social capital in some ways, only because policy-wise, it's very difficult to create. But you certainly can do things policy-wise, and I would say this is a case of it, that hinder it, right? I mean, you're hindering the ability. And the problem is that, like, if you're with a bunch of low-income minority people, there's a good chance that none of them have any connections that are going to do the kinds of things that you need to do, right, in college. And so you, I mean, yeah, I think that's, it's not the way forward in so many different kinds of ways, but even just from an economic standpoint, that we're not doing them a favor. Now, what we need to do is make sure that they do have other people like them in their area, but it doesn't have to be all of them, right? But it needs to be, that there certainly needs to be some comfort there where they can reach to their, to people like them when they have difficulties and they need someone to be able to relate. Like they need to have a network there of their own people, but they also need to have a network where they're bridging out beyond what they've always known and seen.
And correct.
This is where these kind of ideas of cultures of poverty become complicated, because I talk about cultures of poverty, most people don't. Because I do think that, so even one way, an easy, non-painful way to talk about it is I say to people, like, even though I went to WashU, and even when I started making more money, not in my first years as a professor, I made like 63,000 coming out with a family of five. So I wasn't doing really well for a number of years, right? It wasn't really until the last 5 years that I started making real money, which is also problematic, right? So I'm 52 years old, and not to the last 5 years that I started making any real kind of money. Because even my second job as a professor, I made like 72,000, which is still not a lot of money, right?
Wow, that's incredible that they start professors so low. You'd think that after all the, anyways, separate conversation.
Becoming a teacher, right? So the point is, though, is I lost my point there. What were we kind of going to? I forget now.
Social capital.
Yeah, and so even though I started, so I wanted to go on a sidetrack in this, so I lost my sidetrack. Here's my sidetrack,
No
is
worries.
that, which I think is relevant, is that you have to also understand, even if I'm making more money now, I hadn't built up all those assets for all those other years. So sometimes we look at just like, even like my kids are going to college, they don't qualify for any kind of financial aid because of what I'm making now. But that assumes that I've accumulated assets over time, but I wasn't in a position to accumulate a lot of assets over time, right? Because I just started making real money. So those things need to be factored in too. But more back to the point of what we were talking about is this social capital is so real. And I don't hate it because I don't think it's real, but it's just very hard to create policy-wise. But I do think we can do very distinct things to reduce social capital. And so we have to be very mindful of trying to create social capital where we can. But it's
Correct.
so, one more quick example. Even myself, I have a center, and if I hire people and I get a an application from Harvard, and I think, well, this person must be smart. They might be. I've met people from Harvard that aren't necessarily the smartest people in the world, right? I mean, I've met some who are, but it's not a guarantee just because you went to Harvard is that you're
Correct.
really, really smart, right? But we assume that.
100%. Yeah.
And so this is the thing with social capital and the different ways that it comes, is that it gives you the ability to go into the conversation in a positive light. Like that person has to show me they're not smart or not capable, as opposed to someone else who might come in and I think automatically, ooh, can you do this?
Correct.
And I'm a conscious individual. I've talked too much. Let me say two more quick things. I think they're really relevant. There's two epiphanies I've had. Remind me that the second one's on income that I want to tell you about. But the first one is on raise. I've realized that not everyone is racist, but they can hold racist views, right? Those are different things. And so even with myself, I see that because you grow up in a world in which you're taught all these things and fed all these lines, even about sexism. So for example, today there was a lady driving down the street in a utility vehicle, right? So she worked at a utility place. And I never knew that she worked at the utility place. The vehicle I saw parked in the driveway, I always assumed it was her husband that worked there. That's a sexist view. I'm not a sexist because I could then quickly pivot and say, oh, I just screwed that up, right? But I could see where my thinking was wrong. But that also could impact how I interact until I'm made aware of that. Same thing with race, right? It's not everybody has to be a racist. Not there are racists. I'm not trying to sugarcoat that, but there are who just hate black people because they're black and whatever else. And this is difficult for the person who sees themselves not as a racist because they're not a racist. But they doesn't mean they don't hold some racist views that impact their hiring practices, that impact a lot of different things. And that's a very then it's very hard to talk to them because they automatically think you're saying they're a racist. And sometimes we are, because we get in that very accusatory thing. But that might not be they're racist, but they have this racist view that they're not recognizing that they're holding and that they're implementing. Now with income, quickly, is it was epiphany to me that income treats symptoms. And so when we have these discussions, and I relate this back to why it's not just about tuition and why we need to think about assets and having family, having kids leave with some assets is we tend to focus on, and I understand if you see a homeless person or a kid starving or, right, you feel like you got to deal with that first. that really isn't, it's just a symptom of the underlying cause, right? And so we keep treating that symptom of income, but we never treat that underlying cause within a capitalist society is about assets, right? It's the lack of assets prevents the kid from reaching their full potential, which means that they're bound to fall back into poverty, right? So we see so often that cycles of poverty, right? The reason why they cycle is because we keep saying, okay, you're starving today. Here's some money to eat today. But we haven't given them the ability to build their full capacity that would allow them to be able to withstand the things that happen in life. And so we have to treat the symptoms, because if you had a cold, right, you've had a cold, the symptoms suck. I mean, there's an underlying virus there that we really need to deal with. But man, I just want this headache to go away. I just want this sniffling to go away. And that's real. And that affects you from reaching your full potential as well, because then you can't focus as much that day or whatever else. But if all we do is treat that symptom, we can get that to go away for a little while, but it's going to pop back up later. And so this is the same reason why I think income and assets have to work together, but it's not enough for us just to focus on income, whether we're thinking about financial aid or we're thinking about poverty. With regard to income and financial aid, it is you don't have enough money to pay for access today, but we don't think about what they need to get the full return on a degree, which is about assets. Do they come out with some money that allows them to leverage their degree in the same kinds of ways that other students are able to leverage that degree? And if they can't, education will never be a great equalizer in society on the whole. That's a fundamental problem with our way we're financing education and thinking about how we finance education.
That's so fascinating. There was one concept in the research that I found really interesting, and that was that these children's savings accounts are a form of scaffolding. So the research shows that $1, Shapiro, Machete, and Nasoro in 2013 find that in a $1 increase in income translates to a $5 increase in wealth for white families, but only a 70-cent increase for black families. However, when black families start with similar levels of assets, they have a return of $4.03. So fascinating how important assets are. How are child savings accounts a form of scaffolding? And how are they the kind of gateway into building multiple streams of assets? Because I can imagine there's a series of decisions that need to be made for this to happen.
And the other thing about it being scaffolding is, right now, is in our way we create policy. So even from a study of education, there's early educators and they study early education. And then there's people who study secondary, kind of high school and stuff. And there's people who study secondary education, right? And then there's people who study the post-college. But we don't have anything. They're very separate silos. Even if you were to take a degree, you take a degree in early education or one of these other sectors, right? You don't take one that kind of goes across those. So as scaffolding, what CSAs do is, A, they start from birth, and they extend, ideally, all the way through to the cradle. I mean, you know, to the grave, should I say, cradle to grave, right? And so it allows you to have this system of scaffolding across the life course of an individual. We often, for right now, CSAs only go through the time they reach college or shortly after college, but we can think about them in the long term. But what they do is, once the kid has an account, the institutional structure is in place, we can deliver resources to them where they need them throughout the system. We have a mechanism in place to say, we can. So when you reach high school age, you need a dump of money for college. When you graduate, you need a dump of money for post-college, right? So you have this scaffolding in place that allows us to deliver the resources throughout the child's life. Without that, and it also does it in that we know if a person has this scaffolding in place when they're very young, it affects parental expectations, social-emotional development of kids, kids' expectations, parental depression, all these things that we know, parental practices, all these things that we know that are important for a kid to prepare for college. And so with that, it connects this early part to going to college because it helps them prepare for college. It also helps them with a sense of delivering financial aid, financial education and connecting them early on, saying, hey, even at birth, here's a connection to your adult self. And one of the things I talk about is when you start to put aside assets into these accounts, it allows you to begin purchasing a part of your future self, right? I mean, you can, if I have an account and I have money going into that account, I'm not only thinking about college, but I'm already starting to put some money down on it. Think about yourself as a homeowner. If you're just going to a neighborhood and walking through looking at houses, but you don't have any money down, you feel very different than if I have some money put aside for it. I might not have all the money, but I have some money put aside. And so when I walk into there, I feel different because I know that I've actually begun to put some money aside for that. The people who are talking to me feel different about me because they understand that I'm a viable person, right? And so what we're trying to do is give these kids this kind of scaffolding that connects all these different things together. So if I'm doing an after-school program, it can connect to them saving for college and going to college. So if I'm helping them do math tutoring, they can talk about in their math class how they have an account and talk through those, right? It's that thing that begins to connect all these things together for a person that makes that future feel more tangible for them. Like that's a possible path for me that could lead to something productive, as opposed to it being, oh, a promise of money and all these different things. I mean, like now we're really beginning to build up this scaffolding, and we can begin to think about not only the federal government putting money into those accounts, if you have this scaffolding in place, but employers can do it, donors, funders can do it. All these, you have all these different asset streams that can begin to flow in. And why this is so important is because one of the things, going back to your earlier question, that prevents us from making real change is our lack of belief in it, that it's possible, right? And so if all I'm thinking about is the amount of money the federal government can put in, even if they put in $40,000, that's not going to be enough in the long run, right? And so if we can start thinking about a system that allows for assets to be delivered from multiple streams to these low-income kids from multiple places, it becomes possible for us to imagine that we could do this. We're not just relying on the federal government. It's part of it. But we're also relying on all these other possibilities of asset streams to flow into these accounts.
Professor, this is so fascinating because the research, in my opinion, should be more widely distributed for more people to continue having this more nuanced conversation when it comes to students and success rates in university and colleges. I know we're over time, and I wanted to end this conversation by talking about this fascinating quote I found, and again, harkens back to a lot of the comments you've made, but I think this is a great kind of segue. In the research, the research states, insofar as education is believed to be a big part of the social safety net in America, it can never live up to its moniker as the great equalizer if it is not more directly attached to wealth building programs. Why is it that this idea that with a degree, you will become financially successful in the United States without discussing wealth building programs as well? Somehow, if you come out with a Harvard degree, you're going to get a six-figure income and that's going to sustain you for the rest of your life. Why are we not prioritizing wealth building programs as well?
Largely because when we talk about low-income people, is what I gave you that little nugget about income, is that we just always told ourselves that we cannot begin to address assets for the poor until we take care of what we think of as their poverty problem. We think their poverty problem is that they can't eat. The poverty problem is an opportunity problem, which assets provide opportunities in our society, right? And so it's not a I can't eat problem. It is an I can't eat problem, but that's the symptom. The underlying problem is they don't have opportunities. This whole statement goes back to the return on a degree, that in the end, the question that you asked me really has to do with what we've been talking about, is that we have to understand that it's not just about getting a degree. but it's about how we can leverage that degree. If we don't have assets and we start off with debt, that's even worse. It's not, that's why free college is not enough, because it's not just starting off with no debt. It's actually starting off with some assets that allow us to get full power of that degree, right? It allows us to buy that home early on in a decent neighborhood that has higher equity. It allows us to start saving for our retirement. It allows us to invest in our own human capital. It allows us to pick a job that is for our long-term benefit and not just for the immediate, I got to pay back my student loans or I got to eat or whatever else, right? And so these things are what assets allow. It allows us to take risks and invest in businesses that we would not invest in before, or stock market or whatever else. But assets provide that. And so it's not just having knowledge, financial knowledge. It's not just having a degree and having a specific speciality, but it's also about how can I leverage that degree? And that's about the assets that you have that allow you to do that. And so that's why this just can't work like we wanted to, unless we consider the asset position of students, not only their kind of ability to pay for the degree, which would be the income part.
Professor, we've covered a lot of ground in this podcast, and I feel like we've barely scratched the surface of the CSA research that you've put forward, you and others at the University of Michigan, this past few months. And I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that more people are talking about this research and highlighted on all my social media and website as well, because it's just so important. And it provides that nuanced perspective when we're talking about debt relief. One that perhaps we more policymakers, but more people in general need to talk about. You know, I was chatting with a cousin of mine in New Jersey, and we were talking about the protests around student debt and debt relief. And I shared with her my podcast with yourself, and the conversation we had after was, why aren't we also talking about asset building? Why aren't we protesting asset building as part of debt relief to governments? You know, it's just, to me, it's just too important for future generations to not discuss. So I want to say thank you so much for all the work you've done in this field. It's like you're blazing a trail, and more people need to be very much aware of it. They may not agree, but at least be aware of the research that you're doing.
And I'm blazing it because you're setting it on fire. You're the one who actually can get it out there to the masses. So I appreciate you and giving me this opportunity to talk.
Anytime, Professor. Thank you again.